This is Upfront on the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. Thank you so much for joining us today. Anti-government protests continue in Kenya, spearheaded by the country's Gen Z population. The protests erupted in response to planned government tax hikes, which were subsequently scrapped following a series of violent demonstrations. The protests have now transformed into a broader movement demanding accountability and combating corruption within the government. Josephine Muthengi is a young Kenyan journalist and commentator. She tells me that the role of social media in these protests cannot be overstated because it has provided a space for young people to share real-time updates, organize logistics, and foster a sense of community among the protesters. She joins me from Nairobi.
Joey, they're saying that these protests are primarily led by the Gen Zs, and that the only time in Kenyan history where one, aside from they have no leaders, but they're not based on any tribe or affiliation or region. Is
right.
That what you're saying?
That's exactly how it started about a month ago. It was definitely a movement that no one saw coming in terms of its momentum and, you know, the impact it's had. But yes, so the whole thing was that these were young people who were saying we are leaderless, we are partyless, we're tribeless. We just want you to listen to our frustrations. So it did start out as being branded a Gen Z movement, but since it's grown over the past month, it's just pretty much any Kenyan who is fed up with the status quo. These right. frustrations have been bubbling for so long. And so everyone now is included, but it is very youth-led.
And how did the initial protests against the planned government tax hikes evolve into this broader anti-government movement?
To be honest, I think it was social media education, like civic education via social media, because as the protests began because of the finance bill, the very first hashtag was hashtag reject the finance bill, which, you know, we saw kind of go global. And now young people asking themselves, how is my life going to change? My life is hard enough. For example, right now I'm unemployed. I'm trying to make ends meet and you're adding taxes to my life. What does that mean? You know, costs of living. So we started seeing more young people involved in getting to know more about this bill and just realizing how, you know, out of control it was and how many people's lives would be affected and just your daily life, how it would be affected. And so once they were educated, they were like, we cannot have this happen. This is unacceptable. And so that was the beginning of the Gen Z movement was the finance bill, definitely. But it definitely grew from there.
And how has the government responded to these protests, both initially and in the current context?
Initially, I think the government was very much caught off guard. They were like, who are these young children talking to us? You know, they were like, they like to call us my sons and daughters. You know, they were kind of dismissive at the beginning. Like, what do you mean?
Condescending in some way.
Yeah, condescending, yeah. Right? And, you know, young people made it known that we're not going anywhere. We have no jobs. We can do this all day. And so that's when we started seeing the impact, as I was mentioning earlier, where the president actually withdrew the finance bill, even if after it was voted through in parliament. We've recently seen the resignation of the Inspector General of Police, who a lot of people were criticizing during the protest, the firing of the entire cabinet. All of cabinet secretaries were fired by the president. So there has been movement, and that has been encouraging to young people. But there's a sense that it's just not enough. So, you know, as much as we're getting, you know, little bits of, we're seeing, okay, they're listening, at least they're listening to us, but I still don't think that they understand the full extent of why the youth in Kenya are mad. This is right. about much more than the finance bill. It's about corruption and wastefulness and politicians who flaunt their wealth to us and just not being accountable for their expenses. And it's so many things. It's so much deeper than that. And I think that's what young people kind of wish, you know, the old guard would understand. It's so much bigger than just one thing that will silence them.
And how does the involvement of young people in political activism today in Kenya compare to previous generations? I know you and I have over the years spoken time after time about, you know, Kenyan politics, protests, and things of this nature. Mm-hmm. But give us a little comparison on, you know, how you see these, how these are different from the previous ones.
This is very different because the youth who led this movement are fearless. In addition to being leaderless and partyless and tribeless, they're fearless. I feel like as a, you know, a millennial generation and the generations before us, people were kind of content with the status quo. And they're like, this is how things have always been. This is how I've grown up. You know, politics is going to happen regardless of whether I participate or not. You know, it's not about me. People are going to vote according to tribal lines. And that's just what's always happened. And that's what will keep happening. But now this Gen Z movement is saying, no, we do not have to accept that. When you look at just the Kenyan population in general, Gen Zs are 33% of the Kenyan population. And when you add the millennials in that equation, you get about 55%. So these are literally the people who are going to be running the country in the future. So they're saying, no, right now we will not accept it, and we will not continue to accept the way things have been in the past.
Right. And how have the recent economic conditions and political decisions by the new leadership of President Ruto contributed to the unrest? And what specific government policies or actions are being targeted by the protesters? Aside from the tax hike, which we saw in the beginning, what else are they calling for?
There have been so many. There have been housing levies. A lot of it has to do with taxation. And a lot of it has to do with also just our president has traveled way more in the past 2 years than any other Kenyan president has traveled, you know, in that amount of time, if you compare with our previous presidents. We feel like he's always just on a plane, going somewhere, looking for money, you know, borrowing money. We're in debt from the IMF, and we don't understand why you're borrowing all of this money, and yet we're not seeing the results on the ground. You come back for a day or two, we see you, and then you're gone again. In fact, this is the longest President Ruto has been in the country. He's kind of been grounded, has been the joke around these parts, that he hasn't left the country in a month. Wow, you know, he's actually taking time to actually lead and govern. And so we don't really understand, other than him, you know, taking trips abroad, and yes, he's getting those loans, but we don't see, and he's not accountable to us young people as to how that money is being spent. We just feel like the country is going more and more in debt without us. You know, we don't wake up tomorrow and suddenly have more jobs or have more opportunities for entrepreneurship as young people. We're not seeing anything translating based on what he's been doing.
We're chatting with Josephine Muthengi, a Kenyan journalist, commentator, and analyst. She also says that the protests have become a symbol of the Generation Z's disillusionment with systemic corruption and the lack of transparency in government. She joins me from Kenya's capital, Nairobi.
Now, again, there was a little pushback from the beginning. There was condescending remarks by the leader. Mm-hmm. Do you feel that the attitudes are changing or have changed, aside from having not signed the bill? What is the conversation around the government circles nowadays, even with the police, in the way they are reacting to the protests on the streets? Has there been any changes?
There have been changes, and I think, I don't know if they've been to benefit the young people necessarily, because now they're more aware of how we're operating, so they're able to plan in advance. So as we are, you know, utilizing our social media spaces, and we're, you know, saying, you know, Tuesday, let's show up, let's do this, they're also very well prepared. We just had a protest yesterday in which we saw, you know, police violence like we hadn't seen before. You know, the price that we've had to pay for this so far, I believe there have been about 50 recorded deaths, hundreds of people injured, and so forth. And so now they're more prepared to handle the protests in the way that they know how to handle them, which is pretty much kind of, you know, violence and, you know, brutality. There have been lots of arrests, claims of abductions in the dozens. And so I don't know how it's going to go in the future, but it's sort of like they are understanding how we're operating and they're reacting accordingly. So I don't know if that's so much to our advantage anymore.
Right. So, as you're making changes, they're also making changes.
They're also making changes. They're like, okay, we see you. We know how you work.
But what do you see as the potential long-term implications of these protests on Kenya's political landscape?
That's a very good question, because as I said, this started out with just hashtag reject finance bill. Right now, the hashtag that, you know, everyone has been speaking about, like I said, a lot of people, yes, changes have been made, but they're not satisfied. Mm-hmm. So in the end, a lot of young people just feel like this president has to step down. And the hashtag has been Ruto must go. And that's what's being amplified in every planned protest every single week. For an African president, that is a far cry from anything we've seen in the past. And I don't know if that is even possible, because a lot of people are coming back to, okay, so let's just say, in the off chance that he did step down, what's the plan after that?
What's next?
Are things going to get better for us on the ground? Is he the main problem, or can he still make more changes, still being in leadership, and just show young people that he's there to serve the Kenyan people and to listen to their plight? Who knows how this is going to go? But one thing I know is that the young people have been so far relentless, and they've been fierce, and they keep going and keep coming up with new ways, and occupy this and occupy that. And let's look at the healthcare system. Why have interns not been posted for over a year in various hospitals? And so they are, grabbing onto more and more issues that affect their daily lives.
And then finally, I heard somewhere from a Kenyan analyst saying that, over the years, Kenya, one of the few countries in Africa that we've seen, peaceful transfers of power, aside from the 2007, 2008, the trans, the changes in presidency, but that you guys or Kenyans have changed how the presidency works, or how the president, or the power of the presidency. Do you think this is going to be that change that you see now, that the Kenyan president is going to respond more favorably to the demands of the people?
I think he has no choice, because come 2027, if he's still in power and has not listened to the people for the few years we have left to go before the next general election, he will be out. All of his friends will be out. Everybody who did not listen to us, who ridiculed us, who did not think that we could make a difference, will definitely be out. So I think you kind of have to listen to us. Young people are the majority right now. And whether you like it or not, things are changing. The past month has changed more than I've seen kind of change in, 2 decades, in terms of just, people speaking up and being able to do so when they weren't able to do so in the past. So it's right now, it's a time of, you better shape up, or step out.
Shape up or
I
step
think it's
up.
a, yeah, it's a, it's gonna be a huge difference when we come to the next general election, because with all of this civic education, people who weren't registered to vote, young people who weren't registered to vote and felt like their vote didn't matter, now know that they can make a
The
difference.
kind of power they have,
So
yeah.
they're gonna show up, yes.
Absolutely. Joey, thank you so much for taking time to chat with us today.
Thank you, Jackson.
That was Josephine Muthengi, a Kenyan journalist, commentator, and analyst. You're listening to Upfront on the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. July the 18th is International Mandela Day, the day to honor the legacy of the late South African leader and activist. We hit the streets across the continent asking you to talk about the legacy of Nelson Mandela. This is what you said.
Hello, Upfront. My name is Miranda from Kampala, Uganda, a nutrition student at Makerere University. About our hero, the former president of South Africa, Nelson Mandela, we ought to learn a lot from him, being a freedom fighter, his resilience, his ability to stand out for the many voices that couldn't speak for themselves. In this generation, we realize that many of the leaders cannot do the same. They are a bit, they cowardize amidst the challenges that their people are facing, but we need to learn the resilience. We need to learn from the boldness that Nelson Mandela had to stand. He was very selfless, accepting to be in prison for 27 years, and yet not accepting that which was against his people. It is such a great thing that he did.
Hello, Upfront. My name is Nadia Shadia. I'm a fourth-year student at Makerere University, doing Bachelor's of Social Work. What I know about Nelson Mandela, he fought for the independence of South Africa, and also the rights of prisoners. Actually, I read about it in UNADOC, that prisoners also have a right Yeah, for worker freedoms or rights. That's what is practiced in Luzira prison when I went for research. The lesson that you can learn from Nelson Mandela is to never give up. Also have faith in yourself, believe in yourself that you can make a change in your country.
My name is Babu. He set a good example. He fought for the rights of the African people. And the apartheid era, we used to hear about it, apartheid era, and blacks were being marginalized, they were segregated against and all that. He's one of the people who stood up, fought for that, and got the voice of the black people up there for people to know that, you know what, we can stand, we can fight. But his method wasn't violent.
To me as a person, I see him as an icon, because he's always been fighting for our rights, you know, making sure that the Africans are not dispensed, Africans are not treated badly.
Hello, Upfront to the Voice of America. I'm Isaac, and my alias is SMG. I'm a musician. Nelson Mandela has been a sounding name in Uganda to the extent that the government of Uganda constructed a very big stadium here. Actually, the first big stadium is called Mandela National Stadium, and it's just a very big reason as to why we could search about him. This was one of the people who fought for the black voice in Africa, South Africa. Until now, people are still in music. We still sing about him. For example, the song of Busy Signal called "The Great Man." That song was talking about him. He's one of the people who fought for the rights. He was taken to prison. He suffered a lot, and he's just an inspiring person. And he brings me to a conclusion that says, I also want to be like him.
You're listening to Upfront on The Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. Ghanaian filmmakers Nana Poku and Kwaku Awa are working on a production of a documentary which explores Ghana's first president Kwame Nkrumah's use of soccer as a tool to advance his Pan-African ideals. The documentary titled More Than a Goal will showcase how Nkrumah leveraged the sport to promote African unity, challenge colonial stereotypes, and elevate Ghana's international profile.
Thank you guys for joining me today. What inspired you to create this documentary about Kwame Nkrumah's use of football to unify Africa?
In terms of this project really has had its roots back in 2010, since the company for the most part started off. Since the first World Cup that Africa got the chance to host in South Africa. And then every 4 years since then, FIFA Kingdoms has released a collection that kind of ties in with the larger vision of what we want to kind of put forth, which was there's four phases to this, which is to educate, to unite, to build, and then also to keep on with the progress. Because once you reach a certain point, a lot of individuals fail to plan for once they get to a certain, you know, success level, whatever that may be. But with us, these four timelines or points in the timeline match up with the World Cup, and all the collections that we released have some kind of correlation to Nkrumah's larger vision of a united Africa, to that degree, a united diaspora. One of the things that I think we wanted to put forth was for people to see that Kwame Nkrumah wasn't just a politician. As you know, most people look at it as, you know, the president of Ghana, a statesman, but a lot of the stories that's not told is how he utilized football, right, as a tool to unify the continent.
How did Kwame Nkrumah envision using football as a tool for Pan-African unity?
There's different aspects of this, right? So there is the idea of coming forth and letting FIFA, the larger body of organization, knowing that we as Africans have the ability to govern ourselves, and we as Africans have the ability to compete on a larger scale than we're being given credit for. So by showing the skill and the ability of the African, in this instance, the African man playing sports, and Nkrumah was letting the world understand that we will not be pushed around to some degree. We are who we say we're going to be, and we're going to stand by our rules and moral. And whenever we come to the table, you have to respect the African for what we have to offer. So, yeah.
Kwaku.
Yeah, and maybe just to add on to that, you know, football has always been a catalyst on the continent to push for decolonization. You can go back as early as 1924 in Egypt, the club Al Ahly in Egypt, sort of using the platform that they had as a club to kind of push for decolonization and push their voice against, you know, any sort of discrimination against their people. So when Nkrumah comes in power in 1957, he's sort of aware of the unifying power of football. He understands what football has been able to do for certain countries on the continent when it comes to, you know, the idea of self-governance, the idea of rejection of colonialism. And so that's really where the interest sparks. But also Nkrumah played football in high school. Most people don't know that. He was really into a lot of sports in high school. If you go back to some of his early beginnings with some of the voices in the documentary who are very well versatile in telling Nkrumah's story from his birth all the way to his death, you know, Nkrumah was really engaged in sports. So he's already in the know of what sports could do in terms of bringing people together. So yeah. That's really where some of the energy came from. And then, you know, when you add all the things that were happening on the continent at that time with regards to sports, he saw the larger vision more than anyone else.
Right. And what were some of the, I guess, key moments or events where Nkrumah's vision through football was the most evident? And how did this strategy impact the political and social landscape of Africa at the time? Many of the countries were still under colonialism. They were fighting for independence.
Yeah. So I think, you know, it's a very interesting question, a very brilliant one too as well, because all of these things are happening at the same time. And I think that's really where a lot of his efforts through football is overlooked, because a lot of the political things are happening within the same timeline, right? So when Nkrumah gets in power in 1957, he makes this bold claim that Ghana's independence is meaningless unless it's tied or linked with the total liberation of the African continent. So right there and there, Nkrumah is sacrificing Ghana as a base for all liberation movements, right? So so then, you know, obviously CAF, you know, Confederation of African Football, is forming around that same time. You know, by then Ghana gets involved heavily in 1957. Nkrumah, once again, like I said, he knows the power of football. So he gets Ghana right into FIFA. He makes donations, to CAF, sorry. He gets Ghana right into CAF and makes donations towards the sort of the foundation of the Confederation of African Football. One, to gain a larger voice, because he sees the potential of what football could do in terms of unity. He's already aware of that. And so in 1958, Nkrumah also, Ghana becomes part of FIFA, right? And so once again, when Ghana's independence is in play, football becomes the nation's sport. I mean, Stanley Matthews, who is the leading scorer and the European, you know, player of the year in England, is invited to Ghana to play a lot of exhibition games. Right then and there, Nkrumah is setting the stage of what football could be for Ghana and for the continent. Between 1958 and 1962, there's a lot of exhibition games that are being played in Ghana and abroad, right? This is Nkrumah's way of letting the world know that we can compete on the world stage. But at the same time, he's using the platform to voice his ideals of a United States of Africa, right? Because he makes that bold claim in 1958 at the All African People's Conference in Accra, where he says, you know, forward then, you know, the United States of Africa. He makes that bold claim. But football is happening around the same time. So in 1962, Real Madrid, which is, you know, one of the biggest clubs in the world, you know, just won their championship. And then Nkrumah invites them to play the Ghanaian Black Stars in Accra in 1962. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, Ghana was in the lead until the latter minutes of the game when, you know, Real Madrid equalizes and now it's 3-3. But this is Nkrumah's way of showing the world that when the black man is given a chance, he can achieve anything, you know. So this is how Nkrumah was kind of using football as a tool to kind of push this idea of, you know, the black man is capable of managing his own affairs. Because if you look at the landscape, Ghana, throughout all these successes under Nkrumah's regime in football, was the only country on the continent that had an African coach. This is very important because all of the countries were being colonized in a certain way that, you know, even our football, we didn't have black coaches. But Nkrumah made sure that we had a black coach. Ghana had an African coach. And all of these things are happening. And it's clear evidence of what Nkrumah is trying to achieve through football in saying, hey, you know, through Ghana, Africa could find itself. Through Ghana, Africa could see itself. So when neighboring countries are, you know, gain their independence, the Ghanaian team is invited to play what we call a friendly match or a friendly game. This is all part of the process of, you know, showing that we are brothers and sisters, that we belong together, that, you know, football can unite us. But these are all these the ways that Nkrumah was trying to really galvanize this idea of a United States of Africa through sports.
How do you think Nkrumah's vision from way back, almost over 6 years ago, resonates with today's African unity ideal movement?
Well, we know what Nkrumah represented, you know, and we know that what we have now as an African Union is not what Nkrumah was looking for. I mean, you know, this idea of a United States of Africa or an African unity sparked these ideological blocks on the continent. So, you know, we're looking at the Monrovia group, the Casablanca group. So the Casablanca group is Nkrumah's group, for example, which included a lot of the Northern African countries. You know, when people start saying, when people say to me, you know, North Africans don't see themselves as Africans, I laugh at it because when it came down to independence now, liberation now, detached from colonialism now, all of our North African brothers and sisters were in the fight with us. They were part of the Casablanca group. So on one end, you have Nkrumah's group, which is the Casablanca group, saying, hey, if we take our foot off the momentum, what is about to come is going to be worse than where we're going now. So let's try to get together now because this is the time. We have the momentum. Then you have the Monrovia group, which is like, no, let's take time. You know, let's have others, you know, other countries just gain their independence. You know, we don't want to rough feathers. And so when 1963, when the OAU is formed, it's pretty much Nkrumah just compromising because it's either like 100% of nothing or 10% of something, right? But that's not really the type of unity that he was looking for. And people that were backing him at that particular time, those were not the type of unity that we're looking for. So if you look at the landscape of what Nkrumah was pushing for and what we have now, you see that there's a lot of individuality amongst us as a continent, because even though we have these regional blocks, there's still that individual presence, which has caused us more harm than good, because it's very easy to kind of for colonialism to attack from an individual space versus a unity space. And I think that's really what Nkrumah was trying to preach when he talks about all of this in his last book, you know, Neocolonialism, the last phase of imperialism. He talks about all of these things happening if we don't take care of being united and being a united front in the early stages. These are some of the things that we're going to encounter. And it's evident based on the landscape of things now on the continent.
That was Nana Poku and Kwaku Awa, Ghanaian filmmakers that are on a mission to produce a groundbreaking documentary titled More Than a Goal, which delves into the life and legacy of Ghana's first president Kwame Nkrumah's use of soccer to unite Africa. And with that, we come to the end of our show today. Many thanks to our guests and to you for tuning in via whichever platform, on our FM stations or streaming online. Remember to connect with us on all social media platforms. Just search for VOA Africa. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. Have a great week ahead, Africa.